The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm peachy keen.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends, even if it's, this movie.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, we have some unabashed good news. The long unavailable, except via out-of-print DVD television show, Homicide: Life on the Street, will finally soon be available to stream. The show, which originally aired on NBC, will be on Peacock starting August 19th. If you've never watched it, you should. I recommend it. I myself will probably do a rewatch, just because I haven't seen a lot of these episodes in at least a quarter century. It's based on a book by David Simon about his year embedded in the homicide department of the Baltimore PD. And the show is kind of like a mix of NYPD Blue and The Wire, though it's funnier than both. I remember it being kind of funny. Maybe I'm misremembering, but I remember it being amusing. Anyway, you should check it out. I like it a lot, and I'm excited to look at it. There is an issue, however. There's a minor issue here, and this is where what we're talking about comes into play. Sam Adams of Slate reports that the show is coming back in 16:9. Now, I realize I've just thrown out two numbers there. It might not mean anything to you, but I can assure you that it means a lot. Here's a very short explanation, very, very brief. I'm just going to briefly explain what's going on here. Back in the olden days, TVs were nearly square. The proportions were about 4:3, right? 4:3. These days, TVs are designed to kind of mimic the widescreen format of movie theaters. You'll have a hard time finding a TV that isn't in the proportions of 16:9. That's how TVs are made now. All TVs are 16:9, more or less. That means that every TV show made before about 2003 or so, including Homicide, is formatted to fit a 4:3 TV, not a 16:9 TV. So when you put a 4:3 show on a 16:9 screen, you got two options. First option, and the best option, I should add, is that you just show the 4:3 image, and then you put black bars on the side. It's sort of a reversed letterboxing effect. This maintains the original aspect ratio, meaning that no information is lost, no information is added, and you just watch the show like normal. You got some black bars on the side, it's fine. This is how all things should be done. If we weren't savages, this is how we would watch all such shows. The second option is to take the original negatives and reframe the footage shown on the screen to fit widescreen. And this is much trickier. There are ways to do it well, or as well as you can, right? And David Simon himself oversaw one of the better efforts in this regard a decade ago with The Wire, which originally came out in 4:3, was remastered for high def and 16:9 for streaming. And the process was long and complicated and involved reframing shots and occasionally having to digitally remove, you know, boom mics and people from the cast and crew who were on the side of the shot, etc. He wrote a long essay recounting the effort 10 years ago and basically closed up by saying, look, it's a mixed bag, but this might get more people to see it. And fair enough. That's totally reasonable. if that's what it takes to get people to watch the show, great. Sometimes this process is done automatically and without oversight, and that's almost always a disaster. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the show, did this a few years back. It took the what was a 4x3 show, remastered the film, showed it in 16x9, and there were boom mics everywhere. There were crew members standing around. It was not great. It was not great, Bob. There are a handful of remasters that have done this, and they look pretty good, frankly. The best is probably Seinfeld. I will occasionally throw episodes of Seinfeld on Netflix. And first off, it looks great because it was shot on film. It's a high-quality program. It looks really good remastered for high-def 4K. And very few of the jokes are lost by the reframing. Some are. It's not perfect. Again, if you have stuff going on at the top and the bottom of the screen, you're going to run into issues. Whatever. Animation always looks the worst with these efforts, right? So many jokes got lost in The Simpsons when Disney tried something similar that they wound up offering both 4x3 and 16x9 versions of the show to viewers of Disney Plus. And I wish that's what they were doing with Peacock and Homicide: Life on the Street. And frankly, that's what I wish HBO had done with The Wire, offered in both 4x3 and 16x9, but neither here nor there. The reason this happens is because executives believe, and they believe this correctly, that audiences are annoyed by black bars. They say, oh, you're wasting the screen. The image is so small. I want to use the whole screen. Why are you taking screen away from me with these black bars? Black bars are good. The black bars are your friend, folks. It's not wasted screen space. It's preserving authorial intent. It's showing you how it's supposed to be shown. Let the director show you what they wanted to show you. Peter, why can't we have nice things like proper aspect ratios?
I think the real this is very similar to the issue that we have with television settings, where you have motion smoothing, that sort of thing, right? All of these settings that are designed to make a picture pop or sort of look smoother and to stand out in a Best Buy, and then you bring it home and it looks like makes movies look like a soap opera and it looks like garbage, and you just have to go turn off those settings. Except the problem with these DVDs is that it's not a setting that you can turn off. There's not an option to get the original picture there, and this is what irks me, is not even so much that it is being presented in 16x9, but that there's no option to see it in the way that it was originally presented. And that's a really bizarre choice to me. Again, I get what the executives are worried about, but a lot of televisions, I don't know about most, but a lot of televisions actually have an option where the TV itself will reframe a 4x3 picture. It's often called a zoom option, so that you can zoom in and see a 4x3 image in 16x9, and it'll fill your whole screen if you're annoyed by black bars on the side. Why not just let people who want to watch this the wrong way watch it the wrong way with a television setting? Also, it's especially bizarre for something like Homicide: Life on the Street. This is, frankly, not like a huge populace. This is not, I don't know, it's not even The Simpsons, right? This is the audience for Homicide: Life on the Street is going to be a little bit smaller and also, frankly, a little more elite, right? Like people who care about things like original aspect ratio. To present the show in a way that like again, why would you? I just don't understand taking this particular show and doing this to it, because it's hard for me to imagine somebody who in 2024 wants to go back and watch what is at this point a nearly 30-year-old television show that was critically acclaimed but struggled to find viewership at the time, and is somebody who's like, oh, I just can't watch this show with the black bars on the side. How many people are like that? Can there be more than 10?
Yeah, no, and it's interesting too. Again, that essay I referenced by David Simon, he wrote again like 10 or 11 years ago about The Wire. He makes the argument, and it's fair enough, that like The Wire was always a show that had trouble finding an audience. It was correct. It was not well watched. It was hard to get into if you weren't patient, if you didn't want to, deal with the lingo, et cetera.
I mean,
and
especially
so lowering,
at the time, back when that was when serial television at that level was still relatively new, and people found that sort of thing quite intimidating and had to be coaxed and convinced to watch
sure.
it.
Sure. And his argument is, look, if this gets just a few more people watching it, it's worth it. It's fine. We can do this. And whatever. I kind of buy that. But Alyssa, I do think it's kind of, I mean, look, maybe Peter is right, that this is not the sort of thing that will entice new viewers to come, but maybe it will. I don't know.
I mean, I would add one more thing, which is that I think it's actually a good thing for people to kind of be forced to watch things in a range of aspect ratios, right? I mean, there's something kind of funny about accepting the tyranny of a particular type of ratio as, you know, kind of a determining factor in the way that art is made. And I think most people don't think necessarily about the shape of the image that they're viewing, but it matters a lot in terms of sort of the scope of the image that you're presenting or the focus of the image that you're presenting. And getting people used to the idea that film can come in a lot of different, you know, not a lot, but at least multiple shapes and sizes, I think is a, you know, sort of a useful thing in terms of encouraging people to think about the possibilities of the medium expansively.
I think that's a really good point. And it's especially a really good point given where we are and kind of in the film form, like the education about film formats, because one of the things that has happened over the last decade really is that folks, especially Christopher Nolan, but not only Christopher Nolan, have started using multiple aspect ratios inside the same movie. And there's like a whole, I don't know, mass movement, certainly like a cult movement around Christopher Nolan's films, where people want to go see these movies in IMAX, not just so they can see it on a bigger screen, but so that they can see the aspect ratio changes that are happening on the screen as Christopher Nolan wants people to see them, right? Because since The Dark Knight or The Dark Knight Rises, he has frequently used different aspect ratios, like switching back and forth, sometimes within the same scene, right? And it's fascinating because it changes what you like, the amount of information that is available in a shot and the way that shots can be framed, right? It's not just, oh, bigger and smaller, right? It's a part of cinematic language, and people understand that now. So to sort of come back to this cult hit, critically regarded show that is frankly going to appeal to the same sort of cinematically literate people who like Christopher Nolan movies and probably are like, I would prefer to see this in IMAX if I can, even if, yes, sometimes it's difficult to get to an IMAX theater. And to think, oh, we've got to change this so that it fits on your television, so that you won't be annoyed like a dummy. It's weirdly condescending towards the audience here in a way that I just think like a lot of filmmakers have decided not to be condescending and have done well by saying, hey, audiences, like, this is how it was. This is how it's going to be. This is my vision. We should do that. You'll enjoy it. Like, this is how I want you to enjoy it. And people have actually accepted that in ways that that I don't think, like, it's a 1990s approach to doing this sort of thing, where in the 1990s, it was assumed that viewers didn't care about, didn't like subtitles, that they didn't understand aspect ratio changes, right? Like back in the 1990s, it was frequently like VHS, films on VHS were cut to 4:3, even if they were 1.85 or 16 by, or excuse me, not 16 by 9, but 1:2, like 2:4:1 type, you know, widescreen films, which ruined a lot of movies on VHS. It's just stuff you can't see. Yeah. And that was a common way of thinking about mass distribution and home video back then. Why is that still in circulation? Why is that thinking still ruling? And especially why for a show like this? It's bizarre.
No. I'll tell you why. And it's because of the audience. The audience is the problem here. The audience, the people who have for years in the 1980s would get mad at letterboxing. They would be like, why are there bars on the top and the bottom of my screen? I can't see anything. It's too small. Are now saying, why are there bars on the side of my screens? It should take up the whole, I bought a widescreen TV. It should be widescreen. And those are the people who we should be mad at here. I'm less mad at the executives, frankly, because I understand that they know they're dealing with idiots. That's
Sonny,
the problem.
I think this raises the question, who do you hate more, audiences or film Twitter?
Or studio executives.
Audiences, then film Twitter, then studio executives. The thing about studio executives is that they're just responding to stimuli. They're just responding to inputs. The real problems are the people who are giving them those inputs, and that's the people, the masses.
None of whom are among the listeners to Across the Movie Aisle.
No, you are all educated people. You listen to us when we tell you how to do it. No, I mean, look, this is the real part. And so one of my favorite videos, I linked to it in my newsletter this week, but one of my all-time favorite videos, I think it was put together by TCM 30 years ago, and it's Martin Scorsese and, like, Jonathan Demme and Sidney Pollack, a bunch of filmmakers talking about the difference between showing a film in full screen and showing a film in widescreen, and why pan and scan is destructive to the overall idea of the image that you're seeing. And it's just an incredibly useful visual guide to understanding how these things work. And what's been fascinating in recent years, and we'll get off this in a second, this is boring to everybody else, but what's been fascinating in recent years is the way filmmakers have actually been moving to a boxier format. A lot of filmmakers have been kind of shrinking the sides of the screen. I know Robert Eggers has done this a lot. Paul Schrader used this in First Reformed. Wes Anderson in Grand Budapest Hotel and other films has been doing this. And this is also a function of IMAX, right? IMAX, as Peter mentioned, Christopher Nolan in particular, goes with a bunch of different formats. I remember there's a very funny image of the different aspect ratios of Batman versus Superman, which Zack Snyder shot in full IMAX range and, like, intended everybody to see it that way, even though, like, 10 theaters in the country can do it that way. Like, even the, like, multiplex IMAX is not showing you the whole image. And it's just, it's interesting. It's interesting to think about how filmmakers are trying to think of ways to differentiate film from TV. And one of the ways to do that is to get closer to the so-called Academy ratio of 1.37 to one.
I mean, that was the ratio that Kubrick used for a lot of his films. And there has been controversy, actually, about vertical letterboxing, black bars on the sides for Kubrick films, because he shot full frame in many cases, and you lose some of his incredibly stately, perfectly arranged images when you letterbox those things. If you've ever, I can't remember whether it was True Lies or Terminator 2, but there's one of these Cameron films from the early 90s, and I remember you talked about the documentary you saw with all the filmmakers talking about the difference here, but I remember watching a documentary about James Cameron talking about the process of converting a movie from the film letterbox, you know, sort of a ratio onto VHS, and having to go through and pan and scan throughout that whole film. And he said it was basically like redirecting the entire movie, because it's not just that you put a square around the center of it and that's that, because then sometimes the important thing that's happening is at the edge of the frame. Sometimes in order to get a frame that's pleasing, you actually just want to take a square from only a part of it. It's not even, it doesn't even go all the way up through the, you know, through the rectangle. Like, don't do this to films and filmmakers. But also, this is just like, it's weird that it is happening to this and thing specifically, when, for example, I occasionally, by which I mean like all the time, watch some of the old Dini Tim, Andrea Romano, DC animated cartoons, like Batman animated series, Superman animated series, the first Justice League. The only one of those that was shot, that was produced in a widescreen ratio, is Justice League Unlimited. And when you watch these things on Max or HBO or whatever the hell it's called now, they're presented with vertical letterboxing in 4:3, just like they were originally presented. They didn't bother, they're not, you know, zooming in on this, because that's how, well, like, these are kids' shows that are not even being done for sophisticates. And that's just like, that's the way that they're being presented. Why not present Homicide the same way?
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-troversy that a great TV show is being reformatted for a new TV size? Alyssa?
I guess it's controversial.
Peter?
I'm glad the show is finally going to be streaming, but it's annoying. And I guess in that sense, it's controversial.
It's definitely a controversy. Again, just do, like, you already have the 4:3. Just put it on the thing. Just scan that too. Put it on there. I know these things cost money, but still. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for a bonus episode on summer reading. We're going to class it up a little bit following today's review. Speaking of, On to the main event, Deadpool and Wolverine. And I'm just going to say in advance that I have no idea how to discuss this movie without spoilers and talking about the cameos and whatnot. So if you're worried about that sort of thing, if you want to go in fresh, if you're not part of the $200 million opening weekend gross or whatever number finally ends up coming out, so be it. Just consider this your spoiler warning. I'll ramble for another 10 seconds so you can find that off button. Okay. Come back to us whenever you're ready to listen. All right. Deadpool and Wolverine is a movie that I'm going to be honest. I enjoyed it. And I hated myself for enjoying it. I was watching this and I was kind of laughing. And I was like, stop laughing, idiot. This is not funny. You shouldn't be enjoying it this much. Not just because it's aggressively juvenile in the same way that the other Deadpool movies have been aggressively juvenile. And I do think this strain of humor is starting to wear a little thin. Not just because I really do enjoy Ryan Reynolds' trademark smarmy charm, his smarm. I like that. I like that way of describing him. And I like watching Hugh Jackman play Wolverine. He's always been very good in that role. The real problem for me is that I actually understood everything that was happening in this movie, and that made me feel like I've wasted my entire life. And what you have to understand about this film is that it's not simply a team-up movie, though it is that. And it's not just about Deadpool and Wolverine trying to save their universe from destruction by Lady Charles Xavier. Though this is a thing that happens and it is nominally the plot of the movie. No, Deadpool and Wolverine functions very specifically as a goodbye to a quarter century of superhero movies. Again, very specifically, it is a goodbye to the two decades of superhero movies made by 20th Century Fox before that studio's absorption by Disney in 2019. Which is to say that this movie is not just a goodbye to the X-Men and the X-Men universe and all those films. And it's also a goodbye to the Fantastic Four movies, which means that Chris Evans shows up right in this film. And at first you think, oh, he's here as Captain America, but he's not. He's actually the Human Torch. And that's funny. That's a funny gag. I thought made me laugh. It's a goodbye to the Daredevil and Elektra films. Jennifer Garner shows up and she, you know, says that Daredevil's not there. Nobody's sad about it. Ha ha. Because it's Ben Affleck. Because they used to be married. Get it? And it's a goodbye to the Blade movies, though. Those were actually New Line Cinema films, and that's owned by WB now, I think. But whatever, it doesn't matter. It's also a goodbye to the Blade films, because they're doing a new MCU Blade. They got to get rid of the old Blade, and we get in with the new. The thing that really made me question my sanity was the extended joke involving a character who never actually had a movie, Gambit, and the performance by the guy who was long rumored to be playing Gambit, Channing Tatum. And it's a sort of thing that's kind of funny, I guess, if you don't know anything about the comic book movie rumor mill, right? Like, hey, look, it's Channing Tatum. He's having fun. He's always in on the joke. It's just like in Beverly Hills Cop 4. That guy's always up for making fun of himself a little bit. But it's very funny. It's actually a very funny gag. If you knew about the decade plus of Gambit rumors and the Tatum rumors, it was stuck in development hell for like literally 10, 15 years. Forever. Years and years, there was talk about Channing Tatum Gambit, and it was going to be a big hit. Everyone was real excited for it. It never happened. It was always like a year away from starting production. You know, like, oh, we're 6 months away. We're a year away. 6 months. It never happened. Never happened. But it happens here, and it's great. And I hated myself for enjoying it. I hated myself. And that's the problem with this movie, at least for me. This is a very much a personal problem. I don't want to cast aspersions on the film itself, though it deserves some. I really resented that I understood everything in it. I hated that I know what the time variance authority is. I hated that I recognized all the cameos. I knew all those villains. I knew exactly who they were. I hated that I got a little misty from the montage at the end of the film of all the 20th Century Fox films set to that god-awful Green Day song that played at every senior prom between 2007 and 2020. I hate the rushing nesting doll aspect of all the references and in-jokes and knowing them and knowing what they meant. It made me feel bad about myself. The film itself is fine. Look, the film is fine. If you like these movies, you'll enjoy this one. But man, I just don't see how they can keep this going when you have just nothing but like in jokes and references on top. It's the whole thing is going to collapse in on itself like a black star, a black hole, like dying star, black hole. That's what we got here. Alyssa, I have to know. I think you may you're probably more aware of this than the average person, but still, I'm curious. Did you know the backstory of Channing Tatum and Gambit?
Yes.
When he showed up, were you like, yes, finally, the Gambit we've always wanted?
I don't know that I felt that strongly about it, but it was like, oh, yeah, this is a thing that's happened. I don't know if we've talked about this in the podcast before, but my actual introduction to all of these characters was my cousin, who's 2 years older than I am, collected comic cards. And I would literally just sit through and like flip through his comic card collection and like read the backstories on the back of the character on like the backs of the cards. And so I did not have like a stack of Wizard magazines on my bedside table, but I did sort of get this weird, like, you know, sort of proto wiki knowledge of all of these characters from there, and watched like some of the cartoons with him when I was at his house in a break from my like otherwise largely televisionless childhood. So yeah, I would say I am like a little more informed than the average reader, but I definitely like did not experience this movie as judgment on my lifestyle choices. And I should also say,
oh, what must it be like to be you?
You know, I mean, isn't like that's the whole point of this podcast, or figuring out what it's like to be each other. But I also think this is actually it's not a movie. It's an archaeological dig. Right. I mean, this is something that will be incredibly funny to show people in like 25 or 50 years when you're like, do you want to see all of American culture, like corny popular music, boy bands, like, you know, scatological superheroes, but multi, you know, corporate multiverses, like all just sandwiched into a single product? Like, here you go. Here it is. Like, this is our youth. Enjoy. And so, you know, I would say that Deadpool specifically, the Marvel Cinematic Universe broadly, is always going to be slightly less my thing than yours. And I just, like, I laughed. I enjoyed it. But I also was just like, this is a movie where the literal villain is someone who wants to just end all of these continuities and get rid of all of it and kind of have a blank slate. And you know what? Like, I'm on her side. Cassandra Nova is the actual heroine of this story. Like, American pop culture does, in fact, need, like, a complete blank slate from all of this stuff, because it's, like, it's exhausting and increasingly just kind of sad and depressing. And yes, like, she's the villain in the movie, and it's the one thing the movie doesn't seem particularly self-aware about, which I find kind of fascinating.
For as self-aware as this movie is, and for as like kind of faux bad boy as it pretends to be, the thing I was most struck by was just the mawkishness of that that closing montage.
It's
which
so
like
sentimental.
Which
it's
I
so
just don't,
sentimental.
You can't have it both ways. You cannot have it both ways. You can't be both like, oh, look at us naughty guys, we're destroying this whole universe.
Let's literally start this movie with the desecration of a corpse, and then end with, you know,
yeah,
time of your life, right? And I think part of the problem is like that opening sequence is like by far the sort of funniest thing in the movie and like the most amusingly violent, right? I mean, it has a lot of it's like a lot of big group fight sequences, which makes the individual kills just like much less visually, like they don't linger on screen in the same way that the just cavalcade of murders in that first sequence does. And it makes it like, it should be, you should have more fun and a little bit more room to breathe watching Deadpool and Wolverine fight like all of the Deadpool variants, right? Like, you should slow that down a little bit and also not like conceal it in like a blood spattered bus. Like, once you've had Deadpool just murder a bunch of people with Wolverine's like adamantium tinged corpse, like, It's kind of hard to go up from there.
The action is mostly pretty boring, with the maybe exception. I actually think the best action scene is in the middle of the movie when Deadpool and Wolverine fight briefly in a beat up Honda Odyssey. It's a pretty funny gag, and it's handled, I wouldn't say extremely well, but it works. It's pretty good. And the punchline to it, in which we wake up on an overhead shot of Deadpool somehow or another tied up completely in car seats, like the one
car seat
thing,
belts, yeah.
Car seat belts, right? Like, is the one thing that defeated him, because car seat belts are completely indestructible, is in fact kind of funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say it's interesting, the action in this movie, because I do think that that first sequence set to Bye 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 is very funny. And like, I say very funny, it's amusing. And it's like relatively well done, and it's at least coherent visually. And yes. the Honda Odyssey fight is funny, because I am always a sucker for like making fun of product placement and there's a good product placement joke in this. But weirdly, it's all the battle royale stuff that doesn't work at all visually. It's totally incoherent. There's a big fight between Wolverine and Deadpool and the Human Torch and it's after that. It doesn't matter. It's visually incoherent. It's just like you could cut it in any way, edit it in any way, and it would make just
it's
as much visual
super
sense.
Super slapdash and uninterested in the mechanics of who's fighting who or the geography of it. And that's especially true in the fight at the end of the second act, where you have all of the B-list forgotten heroes.
That's Channing the one I was Tatum, thinking of.
Elektra, Channing Tatum as with the card Gambit. Wesley Snipes says,
"How dare you? You know exactly who Gambit is."
Sometimes words just don't appear in my head because they appear as pictures. It's a real problem for somebody who deals in words for a living. Like, I just have the picture in my head, and the word doesn't come out. But no, for the Gambit Blade Elektra fight at the end, and it's a problem in a bunch of ways. First of all, it makes that whole sequence really boring, because the fighting is uninteresting, and the movie is uninterested in the physical mechanics of that fighting. The second problem is that this is supposed to be a send-off to those characters, and it sends them off in a way that is lame. It's not irreverent. It's not funny. It's not interesting. It's just lame. And so the last time we will ever see Wesley Snipes as Blade, one of my, like a foundational superhero character, in many ways sort of presaged, you know, the whole superhero universe gate was sort of set that, like, built the template, that first Blade film, for all of the superhero movies that would come next. Just a groundbreaking kind of thing. Even if Blade is not your speed, like, it really changed Hollywood cinema and in a lot of ways. I mean, Stephen Norrington really sort of delivered The Matrix to us in a bunch of ways with some of those action scenes. Anyway, the last time we're gonna see Wesley Snipes as Blade is just like in this forgotten shot where he's sort of semi-vaporizes Azrath or something as Loki episode 5. What? Like, what a terrible send-off. Why send him off that way? It's like the movie really, like, it just, all over this movie, it just assumes that you care about these characters. It does absolutely nothing to make you care about them in the text of the film. This is a movie that assumes caring at every point in throughout the running time. There is not one minute of this movie in which they try to entice you or give you a reason to care about anything that is happening on screen, because the movie doesn't care about anything that is happening on screen. In a typical movie, you have characters who want things and who have values in life, and then the story is about, like, them trying to get the things they want and having their values tested. The things that they care about most are put in jeopardy. There are stakes for the characters, and you care about them because the characters care. That's how you deepen the engagement with the audience. In fact, that is what Marvel has done at its best, is by raising the stakes effectively for the characters in the film on the screen. This movie has no in-text, on-screen, in-story stakes at all. None. Because the entire stakes are extra textual, are off screen. They are all about whether the Marvel universe is going to be saved. And that's explicit in the movie. Okay, sure. There's like some horse shit about Deadpool caring about his timeline and this, like, the nine people who he cares around the Polaroid. Like, can you name any of those? I guess Colossus, right? You can name Colossus. But, like, who cares? The movie doesn't
Marina
care about
Buckering.
Them. It doesn't expect you to care about them. It's actually totally irrelevant to any of the plot that happens because there is no plot. The entire thing is about him being Marvel Jesus and saving the franchise. It assumes and expects that you already care about the franchise outside of the film itself. It's such a weird thing. And so you have this bizarre sort of, oh, it's proud of itself for being a bad boy, kind of irreverent. No, it's not irreverent at all. It's hyper-reverent. It's incredibly worshipful, but it's lazily worshipful. It doesn't even give you a good reason to worship or be reverential towards any of these characters. It just treats them all like corporate IP slop that you love because you love slop.
Yeah,
right?
No, I mean, look, the final line in Barbie is more shocking than anything in this movie, right? Like,
I saw somebody joke on Twitter or somewhere, Letterboxd maybe, about how, you know, it's really kind of embarrassing to have this whole faux bad boy shtick. Like, we can say anything except jokes about cocaine, but look, we're making jokes about cocaine. And there's zero jokes about Bryan Singer in this. If you really wanted to like push the boundary, there's a way you can do that. And it's the fact that the guy who was the foundational director who got tons of critical accolades for making X-Men and X2, X-Men United, is essentially persona non grata in the industry writ large right now.
Could I ask you guys something that struck me as kind of interesting about this movie and sort of more broadly sort of about kind of the culture that all of us grew up in? Because this movie's pretty, like, kind of comfortably homoerotic, right? It's a, like, it's devotes a lot of time just being like, let's just look at Hugh Jackman. Like, you know, Wolverine kind of, or like, you know, Deadpool kind it's of not, like no. joking. Oh, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I think that I understand what you're saying, but I don't think it's homoerotic as much as like the it's a movie long version of the no homo joke.
Yeah. With the exception of the fact that I think like Deadpool might actually like be willing to go there. But I do think it's interesting that it sort of luxuriates in that so much, given the sort of like the no homo era that like all of us grew up in, right? I mean, like I have talked on the show about how like, you know, I did gay rights activism in high school when that was like not popular. And I don't know that a superhero movie, you know, made in the early years of the stuff this movie is referencing could have done that, would have done that, could have sort of engaged with that, you know, that subtext in all superhero comics. And I don't think, like, again, I don't think the engagement here is, like, sincere. I don't think it's, like, I don't think this is, like, a piece of queer cinema. But I do think it represents, there's something interesting going on there. And I would sort of be interested to hear from you two as former teenage guys how you read that part of the movie.
So I guess this, I see this as an evolution of the subtext in some ways, and the most generous and favorable reading is that all of that subtext that was clearly buried there and, you know, it just in comics generally for decades, Batman and Robin, you know, sort of the most closely excavated of the sort of homoerotic stories or pairs that you see, but all over superhero movies, right? You can read The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay and you sort of see more about that. That sort of stuff was always there and it was always subtext. And this movie shows that the very male, very sort of bro-y fans, like the audience that I saw this at 3 p.m. at the Alamo Drafthouse on opening day. And I will just say that the audience was like virtually all men in their 30s with beards. Like, it was a very, very distinct men in their 30s with beards kind of audience. My people, I guess I'm in my 40s, but like, yes, I'm right. I was there too. And like, they were all fine with it in a way that they would not have been in 1995. My less charitable reading is that this is just another reference, because the movie is just replete with references that don't do anything, that have no point other than to be something that says, hey, remember that? Point. Oh, you recognize it. And that's it. It's just you point at it and it's like, hey, I get a tingly feeling because I recognize the thing. And that is what this movie does with the homoerotic subtext of comic books, is it points it and says, hey, that's there. And we're going to make it explicit. Do you recognize it? Oh, I do. And there's no and. It's just another reference after that.
No, I mean, my read is that it's a bunch of gay panic jokes. And like, frankly, it was funnier in the first one before like another 5 hours of these things, you know, we're following it. I didn't find it offensive, but I also don't think it's like a, you know, big step forward.
Yeah, I just found it just sort of I found the way that aspect of the movie, you know, jibed with my memories of being a teenager in like the, you know, late 90s and early aughts. So it's just, again, I'm not sure I have a deep thought about it, but it was just, I don't know, it was something that struck me a little bit.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Deadpool and Wolverine? Alyssa.
I guess thumbs up in that I was like, I was amused, but it's not like you can save it and watch it on your giant TV at home.
Peter.
Thumbs down. I wasn't even all that amused. There are some decent jokes here and there and a few clever bits, but I think overall this is a real failure. It actually kind of treats the things that it wants to be referenced to. It treats them shabbily. It does not respect. It doesn't respect them. Forget respect, right? Like, it just doesn't care about them. It is a movie that only cares about the winking and the referencing.
Thumbs up! I this movie does exactly what it sets out to do. It's just that what it sets out to do makes me want to kill myself. So, anyway, that's it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.